Venezia, aspettando punta della dogana. Il quarto ospite della serie di incontri promossi da Palazzo Grassi in collaborazione con lo UAB e l'Università Ca' Foscari è Richard Serra. Nella seconda parte dell'incontro con Lynn Cook, l'artista americano parla della necessità di innovare e inventare nuove forme che non siano frutto di una mera ricontestualizzazione dei vecchi linguaggi. Per finire, chiamato a rispondere alle domande del pubblico, spiega quale sia il rapporto tra la sua arte e l'architettura, citando il caso del controverso Tite Arch, quale sia il tipo di interesse che nutre per il paesaggio e che ruolo abbia la luce nei suoi lavori.
You've often said that work comes out of work, and at the same time you've pointed to certain significant experiences, like being in Japan, walking in the gardens in Kyoto, like seeing the Borromini Church in Rome. Would you call these transformative? Are they epiphanies? Do experiences like that change the course of your work, or how does that relate to the fact that work is evolving out of working?
I think, you know, if you're working on a series of ideas or you have a series of thoughts and you've formulated some work, and as the work evolves, the resolution of works point to the potential for other ideas to occur. And you don't know if the resolution of a work is going to spawn other works. Oftentimes you're walking around in your mind's eye and you, through misinterpretation, come upon something that allows you to make a leap within your own humble mechanics to do something or think something you would not have thought if this contingency hadn't arisen in terms of your perception. And I think to see is to think. And if you pay attention to what's coming in simultaneously, no matter what's you're walking around with in your head, perception to a large degree may allow you to see and think in a way you hadn't thought before and can act as a catalyst to change what you were actually thinking about. And when I walked into Borromini's church, I misinterpreted it, and I was more interested in my misinterpretation than what actually was going on there, so I went back and tried to formulate my misinterpretation. I think that's how art probably, to a large degree, evolves, through misinterpretation, mocking, or exaggeration of the generations that come before. If it only evolved linearly through reaffirmation of what had come before, it would be called academic. We would all be doing plein air paintings. That's not what happens. I think every generation decides willfully, hopefully, to misinterpret what has come before, to use it for their own ideological or artistic purposes. It's just grist for the mill. It's just what's out there. And I think probably every younger generation comes up and does just exactly that. They purposely misinterpret the language of their elders or of history, or they reinvent it in terms of their own needs. But if you just rearticulate it, you're probably treading water. Because I think there's a lot of art that's been made that doesn't reinvent form. All it does is lay a new content on an old form. So if you look at pop art, a lot of it's just rehashed cubism with new commodities thrown in. If you look at a lot of what's going on now, if you really are, and if you really do agree that form is something that evolves and it has its own metamorphosis that's dependent on its own internal logic and its own internal necessities and not dependent on the currency and references of what's coming in terms of reality. If you're interested in form, I think you can probably not be overly influenced by the manifestations of serving up new representations in old formal models. And I think for the most part, we have a lot of things that are still in frames or in boxes, no matter what their content is. The form that they're being served up in is a form that we've seen and know thoroughly, and we've known it for a half a century. If you're going to be limited by a frame or you're going to be limited by the internal confines of a box, That's where we are. We're stuck in that convention. If you're going to be limited by casting or modeling, that's where we are. That's not to say that great things can't be done. Giacometti did a lot with an internal box. I mean, Judd did a lot with a box. That's not to say that those are antiquated forms. It's not to say that sequences close. Sequences always branch out. But if you're really interested in the invention of form as form, form to a certain degree negates value. And that remains ongoingly interesting for me.
Thomas Kuhn talked about scientific revolutions being paradigm shifts. I can paraphrase it. What he means is that a big shift takes place, and then for decades, people do a whole lot of work that backs up on it, and it gets to the point that the ground is well understood, and then the swell of that turns it over, and another paradigm shift takes place. And if you look at the history of 20th century art, you might identify two very big moments, somewhere between and including 1907 to 13, or round about that moment, and another moment in the early 60s through the early 70s. Do you think that that is, when you're talking about form having its own necessities?
Yeah, I think paradigm shifts never probably occur through one individual. And I just reread Kuhn actually to think about it, and Kuhn has re-annotated his book. But basically, it takes probably several people probing a similar notion of invention to allow a paradigm shift to occur. I think basically what happened in my generation is people got very interested in the extended field, the possibility of various materials, and time entering into a subjective relationship in relationship to perception. Those things weren't confined by the limits of representation in relation to pedestals, and nor were they involved with the historical representations of a time, of an event, of a place, or, you know, if you take the history of iconography of representation from the equestrian rider right on through to whatever we have today, the balloon dog sequence of it, basically that form, it seems to me, very, very conventional. You'd have to ask yourself, in terms of that, have we really gotten beyond the Guatemala? I mean, does representation really get better than that? I mean, have we really gotten beyond that volume floating in that space? See, I think that if any representation is going to break the mold, then it has to invent structure anew. The reason that Gruenwald is interesting is not because he was painting the crucifixion, is because he found a new structure for the crucifixion, a new form for the crucifixion, a new form for the emotion of pain. And I think that it's probably the responsibility to a degree of younger artists to think about what does it mean to invent form, not what does it mean to reshuffle the deck of representation and just hang it on an old form. I think that basically the evolution of language actually, I'm not saying it's better, but it evolves through the invention of form. That doesn't mean it's better. That just means that's how I see it. And having said that, I'll say this, that for every work of art anyone makes, there's an equal and opposite venue that's equally valid. So I have my opinion of where I think Dušan Malovič is, and other people have their opinions. It's just the way I slice it.
As you already know, perhaps, our university has a small and young school of art, but its fame is one of a very old and influential school of architecture. So I would like to address this issue of relation, very controversial relation between art and architecture, especially for two reasons. The one, I remember the story of tilted arch, that means of the difficult relation between your work and the space of contemporary city. On the other side, because I remember some very interesting experiment of collaboration between you and Frank Gehry, for example, the Millennium Bridge in London, something like a skyscraper for Manhattan several years ago. I remember the more unfortunate experiment with Peter Eisenman for the memorial in Berlin. You are one of the few influential contemporary artist who did take the risk to work, to share his experience with architects. What does it mean? It's changing your work, changing architecture, dreaming a total work of art?
No, I think so? That if you're doing work that deals with the scale that I'm dealing with, it finds itself in sites, and the comparison is necessarily one to the existing surrounding architecture. So the comparison is easily made. It's also the fact that the pieces deal with circulation, they deal with walking and moving, even though they don't deal with connections, that the comparison is made. But if the terms of things you've enumerated, with the Peter Eisenman proposal, he asked me if I would participate in that, and I wrote the brief for it and gave the brief in Berlin and built the model with Peter. But then it came to talking to Helmut Kohl about how the piece was going to find its realization, and Kohl decided to cut it up and by a third, and then I just said I was out of there. I didn't want to deal with that kind of compromise. But basically, my relationship to architects has been fairly problematic, because when you change the function of their space to a condition of sculptural reception, they become very annoyed. I'm interested in the penetration of elements in the landscape that deal with the differentiation in elevation. The main difference between being in architecture and being outside is that the elevation shifts. When you bounce a ball, it doesn't return to your hand. So the boundary isn't always defined by the horizon, particularly if you're in a space that's hilly or whatever. So I'm interested in locating the volumes that occur in landscape through walking elevations. I'm not interested in reframing the landscape in terms of the picturesque, in terms of French gardening, or in the terms of how the picturesque has been developed. In that sense, I'm not interested in what happened in England with Caro and those people when they started putting their piece outside by hedges. I'm interested in redefining and re-seeing the volumes that occur within the field of landscape. I'm not interested in making images within the landscape. The pieces I make are like barometers to see into the field. In and of themselves, they don't exist as anything other than possibilities of viewing through and into, not just looking at. So they don't exist as things in and of themselves. They only exist as markers that bring you into the landscape in relation to how they unfold in time and how they unfold in the field in terms of what they do as you walk. But I'm not interested in the picturesque in that sense. And when Smithson came to visit me in Canada, I think the piece was up here a little while ago, and saw a shift, he started musing about the picturesque. And I told him that that wasn't my interest, that that was his interest. But it's very hard to dissuade somebody from seeing what they need to see. Having said that, I realize that we all have biases. And those biases often prevent us from seeing what there is to be seen. And if you decide beforehand what it is you're going to see and what you're not going to see, you won't see it. And we all labor under those biases every day, whether they're aesthetic, political, economic, who knows, whatever. And I think it would behoove all of us to see if we could somehow see through the screen of those biases. But I know I'm guilty of them as much as anyone else. I obviously have an anti-Duchamp bias.
I would go back to the forms, and I would like to, if there is a sort of narrative that you can recognize in the development of your works, about the right angle. It seems to me that the right angles is challenged and at the end defeated by you. You start by using the right angle also in the splash art pieces, because at the end of the day you are avoiding one right angle, but you are always referring to the other, the back, the one in the back, at the encounter between the wall and the floor. And then you are like trying also always to deviate a little bit from the right angle, and then you end by proposing us these ecliptic movements and these labyrinths that have no straight angles, right angles. So I would like to know if this way of reading the thing is correct, number one, and number two, if there is a narrative that you can understand or explain to us as like a metaphor for something.
No, I think that there's two different branches in the work. I mean, if you look at the work very early on and you think of the rubber pieces, there's no right angles in any of the rubber pieces. When we get to the lead pieces, you can say splashing against the wall was a way of still doing, that was the end of casting for me. I thought if I was going to cast, I would use the architecture as a mold to cast from. But that was the last time I casted anything. If you think of how the work developed, it developed, I've been making curved pieces probably over 35 years. I was making curved pieces in New York. One of the reasons I think there was so much hostility to tilted arc wasn't because it was an arc, it was because of its size, it was because it was a curve. There weren't any curves in New York. You name me an architect that was building curvilinear architecture 35 years ago. There weren't any. Frank Gehry wasn't building curves. Eisenman wasn't building, I don't know anybody who was building curves. That wasn't part of the zeitgeist that was coming out of modernism. There weren't any curves in contemporary architecture. So I started building curves. I built two of them in New York simultaneously, one in the rotary and one tilted arc. And I think what happened was that people were startled by the fact that there was a volumetric curvilinear space fighting for its existence in a city which is basically urbanized vertical grid. And I think that's what disrupted people's perception. The only really architectural monument we have in New York that's involved with curves is the Guggenheim, that sits there like some turtle, and you don't really understand its space until you enter into it. So that idea of a curvilinear space fighting for its existence in an urban landscape got a lot of people annoyed. The fact that it was a leaning curve threatened people. It threatened their bias about what was correct form. And I don't see what you're saying, a narrative, that sounds like there's some logic to the unfolding of the sequence of the work. I don't see it that way, but then I'm making it, because I don't think that the work develops that way. The work doesn't sequentially, linearly develop out of itself, even though in hindsight it does. I think there are various aspects of the work in terms of its vocabulary that are open to me, it's my own toolbox, that I'm using. Because right now when I'm going back to the Grand Palais, I haven't used a flat plate like that probably in 4 years. In the interim, I've probably built several, even a dozen curvilinear pieces. So they're ongoing relationships to form, given what the context demands in terms of what I think I can invent. But I don't see it as a narrative, because in terms of a narrative, even if you splice and dice the narrative, you're always thinking about the connections that occur in terms of the logic of its unfolding in terms of some literary idea, and I don't see my development that way. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's no possibility of not reading a narrative if you want to read one, and everybody's life begins and ends, so obviously we have the chronology of a narrative. But I don't see that chronology unfolding in a linear way in my work. But maybe it does. Maybe I just don't see it. You know, you only know that in hindsight. You don't know it while you're doing it. I mean, I can make a relationship between two lift here, the rubber piece, and the last piece you had up here, which is band, which is a curvilinear piece, and say, aha, there's a narrative. But at the time that I was doing two lift, I didn't know 40 years later I was going to be building curvilinear pieces that were 30 feet wide and 70 feet long. Not a chance. I think if you're a writer or you're a historian, you may think of the unfolding of a narrative that has a beginning and an end. I don't think of myself moving through time in relation to invention, depicting a narrative or illustrating a narrative. But maybe in hindsight, you can lay a narrative on anything. I think that's what we do. And probably to the deficit of what's depicted in most people's eulogies.
Could I ask a personal curiosity? You and the other experts have spoken about your work for the last hour and a half using thousands of different words and adjectives, some of which I must admit I don't really know. Some artists, especially contemporary artists, are all about light, but not once was the word light used in the last hour and a half. I wanted to know what the relationship of your work is to light in your mind.
For me, I don't use light to structure my work. And that may be a deficit, but for the most part, you're offered artificial spaces where the lighting can change. Right now, one of the reasons I'm going to Bilbao is to change the lighting, to see if we can augment the lighting, to see if we can lay out the lighting anew. One of the difficulties we had in the Museum of Modern Art show was that after we put the pieces up, lights would burn out and there was no way of actually accessing the tracks to relight them. That was better in Los Angeles in that there was a person there who spent literally days lighting the pieces, much to my satisfaction. But that's always been a problem for me. But there are people who use light as a structuring device, namely James Turrell, Eliasson, there are probably others, you could probably name them, Krissa, you could probably name them as well, Flavin. But that's not something I do. It's not central to my concerns. Central to my concerns are probably weight, mass, gravity, balance, circulation, time, subjectivity, experience, mass, whatever. But light isn't one of those defining things that characterize my work, nor is color for that matter.